This panel is the surveillance state and domestic spying in the Obama era, tactics to end the Bush legacy. And what we want to talk about here today from a number of different perspectives is the ongoing domestic spying and infiltration and disruption operations in the United States against different communities and political organizations, and the efforts that people are undertaking to both identify and fight back against those, with the recognition that while much of this started in the Bush era, the Obama administration, far from reversing course, appears to be carrying forward many of the same policies and practices. And I think it's important within the National Lawyers Guild and advocates for justice that we have a realistic assessment of exactly what the state is in the United States as to these activities, and tactically what we need to be doing both legally and politically to end these kinds of operations and these efforts. Our speakers today are Stephen Goldberg, Imam Mahdi Bray, Eileen Clancy, and I am Mara Verhaden-Hilliard. I'm a co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice with Carl Messinio, who may also be here a bit later. And I am co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Committee, along with Carol Sobel, who I think is also here. Our first speaker is Stephen Goldberg. He is a civil rights lawyer based in Portland, Oregon. He has been practicing law for 34 years. And currently, he's a member of the legal team on the Al-Haramain v. Obama case, which is challenging the Bush administration's and now the Obama administration's national surveillance program. He is a former co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild International Committee, a member of the board of the Portland chapter of the Guild, and the Northwest Workers Justice Project.
Morning. Pete Seda lived in Ashland, Oregon. He made his living as an arborist, pruning trees for the city and for wealthy Ashlanders. He was a devout, practicing Muslim and had started a foundation to generally promote Islam where he lived and to give away copies of the Quran to U.S. and Canadian prisoners. He was supported by many in the Ashland community, including the rabbi, the one rabbi of the one synagogue in Ashland. In 1997, he met a representative of a Saudi Arabian charity called Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation, which agreed to fund Pete's work. Al-Haramain had branches in many other countries, and the U.S. government believed it was financing terrorist organizations in countries such as Somalia and Chechnya. In 2000, funds from a Canadian donor were channeled through the Oregon Corporation towards relief work in Chechnya, and this ultimately led to surveillance of SEDA and the Oregon Corporation, and an indictment of SEDA based on improperly filing tax returns, nothing related to terrorism, followed. And that case is actually set for trial at this point in March coming up, although it's not clear that will happen. And if you wanted to Google Pete Seda or Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation, you could see a lot of articles and background about that case. So Al-Haramain challenged its designation as a terrorist organization. That's an administrative determination that's made by the Department of Treasury. And it's basically what the Bush administration did by cutting off financing to a lot of these foundations. Now, as part of the process, of the administrative process, the attorneys representing the foundation asked for discovery. And the government, this was in 2004, and the government basically provided various documents to the charity, most of which were newspaper articles, and one of which clearly seemed to be a summary of wiretap conversations, which were basically very innocuous, between a representative of Al-Haramain in Saudi Arabia internationally and several lawyers who represented Al-Haramain, who were primarily in the D.C. area. The document was marked top secret, but everyone assumed that it wasn't classified anymore. Why else would the government have disclosed this information to the lawyers as part of this process? 3 months later, that assumption changed when the FBI contacted the lawyers and other people who had received the document and said, we need to get this document back from you. It was inadvertently disclosed to you. And all copies of the document at that point were supposedly returned, and they were in fact returned from everyone who the FBI talked to, and they only talked to people in the United States at that point. In fact, the document was disclosed to a Washington Post reporter who returned the document to the FBI. And no one thought any more about this. This was in early August, in 2004, until December 2005. What happened in December 2005? There was suddenly an article in the New York Times which disclosed what we call the NSA warrantless surveillance or warrantless wiretap program, but which the government refers to as the TSP. You know what that means? Terrorist Surveillance Program. So, now, in fact, as it turns out, the FBI had not gotten all copies of that document back. And one copy came to Tom Nelson, who is a guild member and an attorney in Portland, Oregon. And Tom and I had worked together on issues regarding Palestine, and he gave the document to me, and we looked at the document together, and we decided, indeed, there was a violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, as well as various constitutional provisions, and we decided to file a complaint based upon FISA. And when we filed the complaint initially, we filed the document with the court as a sealed document, so we followed the procedures fairly carefully. The legal team handling this case has expanded, as the case has expanded and continues to go on. And Zaha Hassan and Lisa Jaskel, who are members of the team, are here. Ashley Albies, who's the president of the Portland chapter, is also on the team, as well as John Eisenberg, who's really become one of the lead attorneys and who's an attorney in Oakland and not yet a member of the guild, but we work on him every day. Now, other lawsuits have been filed challenging the NSA program. CCR filed a suit, the ACLU filed a suit. There were all of these lawsuits filed against the various telecommunication companies that had cooperated with the government under this suit. But now, 3.5 years later, in October 2009, believe it or not, the only case left standing is the case that we're involved in, Al Haramain Islamic Foundation versus now Obama. Now, the litigation history of this case is actually in the materials. You've gotten these CDs. And there have been, so far, 3 reported district court decisions and 1 decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals dealing with the state secrets issue. We're back now in the district court. And all of those citations are on that disk. There was an article in the New Yorker magazine in April, I think it was April 28th of 2008, which described our adventures in drafting our brief in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is an amusing article, and you might want to take a look at that. It has been the most amazing and complicated case I've ever been involved in my years of practice. And there are 3 lessons I want to talk about today. Number 1, one can understand how the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights gets involved in a case like this. But how do a team of lawyers from Oregon initially get involved in such a big case, which I'm sure the government is asked all the time, and why is it that this case is still going on through the courts? And I think, and I'm saying this mostly to the young attorneys here, but not exclusively to the young attorneys here, that the way I got involved in this case arose out of the political work that I was doing with Tom. Tom and I had worked on Palestinian work. Tom got involved with this case. He got me involved in this case. Nobody came to Stephen Goldberg or Lisa Jaskel and said, please represent us in this case. They came to us as members of the guild and as a result of the political work we've done. I was involved in a case a couple of years ago, which I thought then was the most amazing case I'd been involved in, which was a challenge to the Army Stop Loss Program. And Lisa also worked with me on that case. And again, the National Guardsmen who challenged that program didn't search out Stephen Goldberg to handle that case. He wanted a lawyer. He came to the Guild because of the anti-military work that the Guild had done over the years. So the lesson is, if you want to get involved in these kinds of amazing cases, do political work. That's how you're going to get these cases. If you're not Jerry Spence, most of us are going to get these cases, not because of who we are, but really because of the work we do. And that's lesson number one. Lesson number two, why is this case important? The government asks that question all the time whenever we're in court, because according to the government, at least, the warrantless wiretap program was ended in early 2007. And if we have time for questions, I could explain why the case isn't moot and while we're still standing there. But why is this case really important? The case does involve issues of how to deal with classified documents and state secrets privilege, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But most fundamentally, this case is about what limits there are on the assertion of inherent presidential authority by the executive in the context of national security. Now, that issue was addressed in the Guantanamo cases, such as Boumediene, but only in the context of habeas. Those cases are fairly restricted to habeas corpus cases. But there have been no cases yet where a court has said that what the Bush-Cheney administration did was unconstitutional. There are principles here. The principles arise primarily out of what are known the Steele seizure cases, which are back from the early 50s when Truman tried to nationalize the steel industry. And some principles arose in those cases, but there have been very few cases discussing those principles since that time. This case poses that issue. There are many other cases, by the way, that have talked about the legal context and the political context of this case. And you should read the case the book by the New York Times reporter Eric Lichtblau, wrote a book called Bush's War. There's a great case, a book by Jane Mayer, a New Yorker reporter, called The Dark Side. And there's also a book by James Bamford about the NSA surveillance program. But in terms of the legal principle, this is a case we hope that will ultimately establish the principle that what the Bush-Cheney administration tried to do was illegal and unconstitutional, and that no other executive should be doing this in the future. That's number two. Number three, I want to finally talk about the issue of the classified document and how that's been handled by the courts, because if you do these cases, that will become an issue in the case. From day one in this case, the government took the position that we could not use this document that we had, and we needed it initially, we thought, to establish standing in the case, that we could not use it based on something called the state secrets privilege. So 3.5 years ago, we all said, what? I mean, what is the state secrets privilege? The privilege has been around since a 1953 U.S. Supreme Court decision called U.S. versus Reynolds. And it's been rarely, rarely used at that time until the Bush administration, which began to assert the state secrets privilege over and over again, and the Obama administration has learned how to do it quite well also. Now, it's not unusual that classified documents are used in cases. For example, if any of you do criminal cases, there's in fact a separate law, it's called SEPA, which sets forth procedures for using classified documents in criminal cases. Classified documents are being used in the Guantanamo cases right now. But by asserting the state secrets privilege in our case, the government was saying two things. Number one, and this is what the privilege says, the case must be dismissed because the very subject matter of the case is a threat to national security. The government's position, and they have said this in court to the judge, is that if you decide that these people were surveyed without a warrant, that will be a threat to national security. That will signal all sorts of information to our enemies out there. On the other hand, if you decide that there was a warrant in this case, that will also be a threat to national security, and that will signal all sorts of information to our enemies out there. So therefore, Judge, you cannot decide this case. The very subject matter of this case is a threat to national security. Now, the second part of the state secrets privilege is that even if the subject matter is not a threat, the use of the document is a threat. And if the court agrees that the state secret privilege applies, then the document cannot be used in the litigation at all. There's no balancing of interests. There's no use of protective orders. The document is out. So for the first years of the case, and the case was initially filed in Oregon federal court, it was moved through something called the panel on multi-district litigation to the Northern District of California, and that's where the case is at this point. But after the Oregon decision, and the judge basically tried to find a way to get around the state secrets privilege, the government appealed that to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit held that, indeed, we've looked at the document, it is a threat to national security, and therefore the state secret privilege keeps you from using this document. We were somewhat surprised by that ruling, since we had seen the document, and at least we couldn't see what was going on. But we also didn't see the classified filings that the government made to the Ninth Circuit explaining why this document was so serious. So when we wrote our brief to the Ninth Circuit, we could talk about the document as long as we went to this secure room in the federal building in San Francisco and wrote our arguments on the brief on a computer given to us by the government, and which then printed out copies of the argument, gave it to the three judges, but we weren't allowed to keep copies of what we had written. So that, again, read the New Yorker article, and then I'll talk all about that. But we didn't know what the government was saying, so we really weren't able to argue much to the Ninth Circuit. Nonetheless, they decided we couldn't use the document. But there, we had not a bad panel in the Ninth Circuit, and there was a significant but in their decision. Because FISA, which we had sued under, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, has a separate provision regarding the use of classified evidence in litigation. No one had ever litigated or talked about, there are no cases about that provision. But the Ninth Circuit said, and we had argued this, it is possible that that provision preempts the state secrets privilege. And if it does, even though you can't use a document based on the state secrets privilege, you can use it, maybe, based on this provision in FISA. So we're going to send it back to the district court to resolve that issue. So we breathed a sigh of relief, and we went back to the district court. And the court, the district court then issued a decision agreeing that the provision in FISA preempted the state secrets privilege. Great decision. But there was a significant but in that decision as well. Because the court said, but before you can use that provision, you have to make a preliminary showing that you are covered by FISA. In other words, that you were subject to electronic surveillance. And you have to make that preliminary showing without using classified evidence. So, I mean, this is driving us crazy. We had the document. I'd seen the document. I knew what the document said. I knew the document would allow us to establish our case, but we, at this point, still couldn't use the document. But in the years since we filed the case, there had been more and more admissions and testimony by the administration about the warrantless wiretap program, primarily through congressional testimony. At the time, FISA was amended in the summer of 2008. In fact, the assistant director of the FBI had given a speech to a national banking association, and remember, finances and controlling finances was a big issue here, in which he said and acknowledged something which the government attorneys had refused to acknowledge, that yes, we had surveyed Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation, and Eisenberg found this on the FBI's website. So we put together a very, very detailed amended complaint which spelled out each step of our analysis of why we felt we could prove, at least make a prima facie showing, that we had been subject to electronic surveillance under FISA. And the judge, Judge Vaughn Walker, who's the chief judge of the Northern District in California, in fact said, you're right, you did it. And he actually began the hearing by coming out, and when the government attorney stood up, said, made a statement about, well, Mr. Coppolino is a Department of Justice attorney, there sure seems to be meat on them bones at this point. And we smiled. So the judge then set forth very detailed procedures about how we were going to use classified evidence in our case. He ordered that we could designate up to 3 attorneys on our team to get security clearances. He ordered the government and the plaintiffs to come up with a protective order that would be used in the case. So we then go to the process of the application for security clearances, which was great fun, because we needed not just a top secret security clearance, but what we had learned about this case, this is a whole nother lecture, is that there's a separate way that the government classifies intelligence documents. And those documents, this document was also designated what is called an SCI document, a sensitive compartmented information document. So not only was it top secret, but it was an SCI. And SCI documents can't be kept, like, for example, in a judge's safe in his courtroom, like other classified documents, but they have to be kept in SCI facilities, what is called a SCIF. And a SCIF is an alarmed facility with no seams on the walls. And we spent actually the first couple of months in our litigation arguing about where the document should be kept. The government would go to the district court judge in Oregon and said, we're going to take that document from you. The judge would say, no, you're not. And the government would say, well, we need to keep it in a SCIF. And the court said, well, where's the SCIF in Oregon? And the government said, well, it's in the FBI's office. And we said, wait a minute, we sued the FBI. They can't have the document. So they had to transport the document to Seattle. I mean, there are... Anyway. In any case, even after we got these security and clearances, or two of us got top secret and SCI security clearances, another story about being interviewed by an FBI agent with my pictures of Cuba on the wall. That was fun, too. But I got this clearance. Nonetheless, the government's position has been, we don't really care if these guys have these clearances. The bottom line is we're not going to release this document. That really has still been the position of the government. The court then held a hearing last June in which it was an order to show cause as to whether the government should be held in contempt for refusing to cooperate in terms of drafting a protective order in the case. And that hearing was held, but the judge did blink first in that hearing. I think the judge realized that once he ordered that the document be disclosed to us and the other classified filings be disclosed to us, the government would get an immediate appeal to the Ninth Circuit. They had tried to appeal his initial order on an interlocutory basis and as of right, but the Ninth Circuit dismissed that appeal. But the court said if they disclosed the document to us, he thought that they could get an appeal, and we think this judge wants to issue a decision on the merits. So he came back to us and said, file a motion for summary judgment to resolve this case, but don't use classified evidence. If the government responds using classified evidence, I'll disclose it to you. But let's see what the government does first. We filed our motion without using classified evidence. The government, in fact, did not respond using classified evidence. They simply responded by saying, number one, the non-classified evidence you filed isn't enough to prove your case, and that's it. We, the government, should win. The government never addressed the merits of the litigation in their brief. And we think part of the reason for that is because our brief half the time quoted Obama administration people about why they thought this program was illegal and unconstitutional. So we were kind of interested in hearing what they would say in court, but they didn't. In any case, that decision or that hearing was held about a month or so ago, and that decision is pending. So we should get that decision any time. We expect, and let me just conclude by saying this, that the issue of the use of classified documents under FISA will eventually be held by the Ninth Circuit and maybe one day by the Supreme Court. And we're hopeful, and we've seen this now in other cases, that as we move further away from September 11th, there have been recent decisions showing that courts have been less sympathetic to assertions of state secrets and national security. The Obama people are still asserting the privilege. There was an article in the New York Times and in other papers reporting that they have a new procedure for how they're going to review documents under the state secrets privilege, but it doesn't in any way change the way or the arguments they're making about the use of that privilege. So in our case up to now, and the judges repeatedly asked the government, have you talked to the people in the Obama administration? Is your position really what you're saying? And the government attorneys say, we have spoken to the highest levels in the Obama administration, and we are absolutely making these representations with that authorization. But there have been some cases. I'll give you one example. Horn versus Huddle is a Washington, D.C. case by Judge Lamberth, who was the head of the secret court created by FISA and not known as a deep-seated liberal. But Judge... Yes, a little bit. Judge Lamberth issued a decision. If you want to read it, it's a 2009. I only have a Westlaw citation, 2610100. That was a Bivens action brought by a former employee of the Drug Enforcement Administration alleging that there had been wiretapping of him in Burma. In that case, actually, the court rejected the assertion of the state secrets privilege, and to deal with classified evidence, the court ordered that the defense or the plaintiff's attorneys get security clearances. The government responded by settling the case. That case had settled. But there have been other examples as well that the courts maybe are getting a little bit more willing to not just back off when the government screams national security. In the meantime, there is one other thing going on. Congress does have a law. There is a law pending in Congress about changing the state secrets privilege, although no one believes that that law is going anywhere at this point. So I encourage you to get involved in these cases. A lot of our pleadings are on the materials that you have. We're certainly, any of us, available to talk to you and to consult with you about handling our case, and keep reading about Al-Haramain. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve Goldberg.